Right, so this week we're going to talk about living in groups, which to me is possibly the most fundamental lecture in this whole series, because it talks about really the reasons why animals form groups. And if you haven't noticed, we do a lot of studying of group living animals in our department or in the chair of biodiversity and collective behavior, because we're interested fundamentally in the processes that occur once animals form groups. So today I'm going to talk to you about the sort of primary reasons why animals join groups in the first place. And in case you hadn't noticed, going out in nature and watching animals, there are many, many animals that form groups across all the different taxonomic groups, from invertebrates to vertebrates, and across all the different types of vertebrates as well. And they form all sorts of different types of groups. Once they do form groups, then lots of different systems emerge, like mating systems, such as what Adriana was talking to you about last week. But fundamentally, the reasons to form groups is often generated by more fundamental ecological reasons. And these groups can be quite spectacular. So when we talk about collective behavior, we're often talking about what happens when many thousands of individuals come together, such as flocks of starlings and schools of fish. And there are, as I said, there's a lot of diversity of different types of groups, and we often give them different kinds of names. So in insects, we talk about swarms of insects or colonies of insects. In fish, we talk about shoals or schools. Birds, flocks or colonies as well. Mammals, we talk about herds, prides, packs and things. But these are fundamentally the same sort of thing. They're basically individual animals that make some decisions to join, to be close to other animals. And so we should first think about defining social behavior. What do we mean by social behavior? Well, we mean activities among members usually of the same species, but sometimes different species, that have some fitness consequences for both the focal individual and other individuals in the group. And this is what's important, right? This is the fitness consequences means that there's something that is beneficial or costly to it as a function of the kinds of decisions that it makes. Okay, and again, talk about fitness as the genes of the successful organism. So the genes that are underpinning the reason why it forms groups are more represented in the next generation. And there are kind of two kind of questions that we can ask. The first question is, why do animals form groups in the first place? And the other question is, why do animals maintain groups? And both of these, Alexander in 1974 proposed that group living represents a trade-off between costs and benefits. So individuals live in groups if the benefits for forming a group or forming an association with other individuals exceeds the costs that are involved. And these benefits can include both direct and indirect fitness benefits, but today I'm going to talk just about direct fitness benefits and also talk to you about the costs involved with forming groups. So we can think about this from an economic perspective. So when you're talking about costs and benefits, often we think about economics, and going to classical behavioral ecology is based around economic decision-making about optimal foraging or optimal group sizes. So this is the example for an optimal group size. This is how we get to the optimal group size. So the idea is that if you go from a group of one to a group of some size n, the costs involved with being in the group increases. These are costs associated with competition or disease and things like that. We'll talk about these. At the same time, the benefits increase, but the amount of increase that the benefits get sort of decreases. So adding one more individual, being a group of a slightly bigger size, if you're already in a large group, makes very little difference to the benefits that you get. And if you take the difference between, so say like the distance between these two lines, so this line minus that line, you get a curve something like this, such that the benefits minus the cost initially increases until you get to some maximum, which is somewhere around here. The distance between them is largest around here. And then it goes down and goes, importantly, below the point at which an individual, the ratio of costs and benefits that an individual has in a group size by itself, a group size of one. Okay, so it has some kind of ratio of these costs and benefits when it's by itself. When it forms a slightly bigger group, they get more benefits relative to the costs. As the groups become very large, those go down to some point where it's more costly to be in a larger group than it is to be by yourself. And so what's important about this function is there are two different points. The first is what we call the optimal group size. This is the group size in which the benefits are maximized relative to the costs. The second point is the maximum group size. We should never observe groups that are larger than this, because for any individuals in those groups, they might as well just be by themselves, because they would get a larger benefit to cost ratio. Okay. What's in the 1970s, there's a very influential paper that suggests that we should never observe individuals in groups of an optimal group size. The reason being that if you have a group that is the optimal group size and you have an individual by itself, that individual will benefit by joining that group. So everyone in the group will lose a little bit of benefit, but all the individuals by themselves will benefit a lot by joining that group. And this process will keep happening until basically you get at an equilibrium where most groups are either at the maximum group size or at a group size of one. That is the only stable state in the system. But that's not hugely important. Okay, so when we think about benefits and costs, we're thinking about things like benefits being anti-predator benefits, benefits related to finding food, and benefits related to reproduction. These are basically the three fundamentals of an animal's life. An animal has to survive by not being eaten, has to survive by finding food, and has to find enough food in order to reproduce. In terms of costs, what we're talking about is disease. So disease, along with predation, are the things that are likely to kill animals before their sort of maximum lifespan. And also competition, right? Competition for resources against other individuals. So I think, to me, the most fundamental, or one of the most fundamental drivers of social behavior is the anti-predator benefits that we get. Predation is an incredibly powerful source of selection. And there's a very, very simple mathematical relationship between the group size in which you're in and the risk in which you face from predators. And we call this a dilution of risk, in which larger groups have lower risk from predators. So imagine if you have a predator that is flying through space, and it finds a group of birds, in this case these little tree sparrows, and it hunts and it catches one of those birds. Now the probability that any one of these birds will be the one that's eaten by the sparrowhawk will be 1 divided by the number of birds present, right? It can only catch a single prey, it only eats a single prey at a time, and so each of these, in this case, have a 1 in 5 chance of being the one that is eaten. And that's what this relationship is 1 divided by n, and this relationship has this form here. And again, this reflects a little bit about the decreasing benefits that come with larger and larger group sizes. If you're in a group of 1, then your per capita risk is 1 divided by 1, which is 1. If you're in a group of 2, then it's 1/2, and so you've dropped by a whole 0.5. But if you're in a group of 3, it's 1 over 3, and so you've actually dropped only by 1/6 of a percentage point, right? And so on. So the amount that this decreases slows down as the group size gets larger. Okay, so the biggest benefit comes from joining any group relative to being alone. Now, surprisingly, there's not a huge amount of empirical literature on this, even though it's such a fundamental thing. But the classic study is by Foster and Traherne. And they studied these water spiders, These water striders live on top of the water, and they make a really great test of this predation risk, because they get predated by fish, and the fish can come up and pick basically any single one of them. It's basically random. And what they observe is they have a predicted line. So this is the predicted relationship between group size and the number of attacks per individual per 5 minutes. Note that this is on the logs. This is a log-log plot, so these are actually curves like this, but they've logged the two axes, which makes 2 straight lines. So this is a predicted one, and this is what they observe. They observe a decrease in the number of attacks per individual as a function of group size. Very, very close to what the prediction of 1 over n suggests. So it's pretty good evidence that these water striders are really benefiting from being in larger groups. Now, 1 over n always assumes that the predator is always successful, But of course, it could also sometimes be successful or not successful. So there's some kind of probability that the predator will be unsuccessful. And that probability can also be related to group size. So it can increase in larger groups, or it can decrease in larger groups. And so we can plot this as some probability as a function of n divided by n, where k of n is the increase or decrease. In this case, if you just have a linear relationship between group size and the probability that the predator is successful, then this is the standard 1 over n, and this is what k over n looks like. And you get some point in which there's basically zero probability that it will catch any individuals in that group. How does this work? Well, a second benefit that has been suggested and shown is that larger groups confuse predators. Okay, so this is what we call predator confusion, in which individuals that are in larger groups have a disproportionately lower risk because it's much more difficult to catch fish in larger groups. This seems a bit counterintuitive because, of course, there's more fish to catch. But if you have a look at this video of these fish, it's very difficult to track one single fish. And so imagine a predator is kind of going for that fish, but then it makes a mistake because it can't keep track of that fish in its field of view, because you get all this movement and confusing effect of fish going in front and behind each other. And this is one of the reasons why people think that fish have evolved things like stripes and so on, is that because when they move in and out from each other, it's very difficult to disentangle one fish from the other, and then they split, and then your eyes can't figure out which fish to follow. So the idea here is that a predator that is attacking a large shoal of fish will basically often catch nothing because it just gets so confused that it can't target any one individual. And there's pretty good evidence for this. We talked briefly about this study a few weeks ago. This is the study Ballandau and Trebor. And what they show is the number of prey in a school and the time for prey capture. And so you see, if you have a single individual in a school, so just an individual by itself, it's very, very fast for this bass to catch this minnow. When there's two, it's a little bit slower. When three, it's a little bit slower again. And as soon as you get schools of six or more, then it becomes very, very, very slow. Right, but this benefit is not necessarily equal for all individuals in a group or for all groups. If we look at this bar of 8 here, what we see is a very large error. So sometimes the value is small and sometimes the value is very large. And this is where they looked at the composition effect. So this is what we call the oddity effect. So this is a cost that individuals incur if they're in the wrong type of group, which is that if you're different, then you're really obvious. Okay, so this zebra, if you have a lion that's chasing the zebra, it's almost always going to go for the zebra because it can easily determine which one is the zebra relative to all of the other individuals. Whereas it's very confusing if you attack here and these two individuals split in different directions, then you're kind of confused because what you thought was maybe one animal suddenly becomes two animals. And so they had in this study, they had two different color morphs of these silvery minnows, and they changed the composition, the number of blue, the number of these ones within one group. So these are always groups of eight. And you see that if they're mostly all of one type or the other type, then, if one type is very rare, either there's only one or two blue ones or one or two brown ones, then the percentage of trials that end in capture is very high. Whereas if the group is more evenly split, then the percentage of trials that end in capture is lower. Okay, so if you have just one or two of these odd individuals, then the predators actually hunt them in a way that is almost the same as if they were just in a prey school of one or two. Okay, so you can just ignore the ones that are different colors and focus just on those unusual ones. Okay, back to benefits. Another reason why a predator might not be successful at catching a prey when it attacks a group is because larger groups might be better at detecting the prey and the predators in the first place. Okay, so we have benefits that come from predator detection, which are often called benefits that come from having many eyes. And so there are many eyes in the group looking out for predators, and they have a greater likelihood of detecting the predator sooner, but also there's more eyes looking at any one time. So if you think about every individual in this group having to spend some time feeding with its head down when it can't detect a predator, the number of individuals with their head up at any one time will be always larger in larger groups, so there are just more individuals on the lookout for predators. There's some pretty good empirical evidence for this. So this is a study looking at goshawks, these rather large accipiter hawks hunting these large wood pigeons. And if we look at first the predator's perspective, the probability or the number of successful attacks, the percentage of having a successful attack, as a function of how far away from the pigeons it was detected, really decreases. So if it gets up very, very close to the pigeons before it's detected, then it has almost a 50% chance of being successful. As soon as it gets out to about 20 meters, that drops down to maybe 10%. And if it's detected at 40 meters, it's basically never, ever successful. So this suggests that there's a really big benefit for these pigeons to see that goshawk as early as possible. And we can see that this happens more in the larger group. So this is the number of pigeons in the group, and this is the distance at which they detected the hawk. So this is the same as this axis here. And what we found is that single pigeons by themselves, basically they almost don't detect the hawk. Basically they just detect it when they get attacked. But if you get very large groups, then you get into these very large distances. So they're detecting the hawk very, very early. And so goshawks, if we sort of combine these two plots, they're much less successful at hunting larger groups. So this is the number of successful attacks again, and this is the number of pigeons. If there's only one pigeon, then they get them about 80% of the time. But if there's large groups, then it gets down to below 10% of the time. And if you think about the fact that for a predator, it's also very expensive to hunt, right? It takes a lot of energy and there's a lot of risk involved for a predator, then a predator might attack large groups much less often because it also knows that it has less chance of being successful. And so these are sort of cumulative benefits that groups of prey have. Okay, once they do detect the predator, they can also benefit by trying to repulse the predator, or sort of spreading information about its presence very early and then trying to get the predator to move away through mobbing. Okay, so we have information spread about predators, which is much more rapid when there's more individuals present, and predator repulsion. So this is a really neat study. So these are North American chickadees. These are like the tits, the miser that we have here in Germany, but closely related species in North America. And these little guys really don't like sparrowhawks and small hawks. And they actually encode information in their alarm call about the size of the predator that they've encountered or that they've observed. And basically they do this by adding D notes into their call. So these are high-pitched. They start with a high-pitched alarm, and then they have a number of more lower-pitched, broad-frequency notes, which they call D notes. And the more of these they have, the more dangerous they're signaling the predator is. Okay, so if they're presented with a large predator has very little risk because it's basically almost impossible for a large predator to catch a chickadee. They might just encode one or two D notes. But if they get a very, very risky predator, such as a sharp-shinned hawk, which is the equivalent of our sparrowhawk here, then they will encode many, many more D notes. And you can see this relationship is a function of the body size of the predator here. So the larger the predator in terms of its wingspan or its body length, the more D notes it puts in the call. So they obviously really don't like these small owls, saw-whet owls and pygmy owls. Pygmy owls are specialists on hunting chickadees. They really hate those. They really hate merlins, which are small falcons, Cooper's hawks, and so on. Now, once they detect a predator and they send the alarm call and the predator stops hunting, then they also want that predator to go away. Right? They want to try and chase the predator away from the area. And so they do what we call mobbing. So they will come, some of you might have seen this, they will sort of come and attack the predator. They'll scream at it, often in a large group. We call it mobbing because it's often a mob of small birds having a go at a large predator. And so in this study, they showed that the hypothesis that mobbing works by getting the predator to move on is supported. They looked at kestrels that were being mobbed by small birds, and they found that the difference in the sort of distance traveled after they'd been mobbed is much larger than the distance traveled if they hadn't been mobbed. So if you look at a kestrel hunting and then moving on somewhere, if it hadn't been mobbed, it only moves maybe 150 meters on average, but it has been mobbed, it might move close to 400 meters away. Okay, so mobbing really gets the predator out of the area. And of course, one of the reasons why a predator might move on is because it knows that it's not going to be successful in this place, right? Because most predators really rely on ambush tactics. They rely on getting very close to the prey before the prey being seen. So if we think about lions or cheetahs in the African savannah, you know that they crouch down, they're very quiet, very stealthy, because they want to get as close to the prey as possible, because that greatly increases their chances of being successful. If the prey know that they're there, they're never going to get close, right? Because as soon as they come towards them, then the prey are just going to keep moving away. Okay, so those are anti-predator benefits. There are also a bunch of foraging benefits, so in terms of the amount of food that an individual gets. So we talked a little bit before about vigilance rates. So when you have larger groups, there are more individuals being vigilant at any one time. This also allows individuals in larger group to forage at a higher rate. They don't have to look up as often because the looking up is being shared by more individuals. So basically, they can let others do some of the watching. And this was looked at by John Krebs in 1972. For those of you who don't know John Krebs wrote the textbook on behavioral ecology in the 1970s, along with Nick Davies. And he studied these grey herons in North America, and he looked at the group size, so the number of individual herons that were sort of in an area together, and the intake rate, the number of grams of food that they took in every minute. And he showed this really strong sort of positive relationship here. Okay, so individuals that were in larger groups were taking more food per unit time. And if you think about the fact that animals are very time limited, they only have so many hours in a day in which to forage, and they might get at a patch that suddenly has lots of rich food and they need to get as much of that food as possible before it disappears, then foraging at almost five times the same rate is going to give you many, many benefits. Now they also, when it comes to finding food, we talk about patches, a lot of animals live in an environment that seems very homogeneous, but actually the food can be very patchy. You get small areas that have more food than other areas. You can think about this from the perspective of a sparrowhawk. A sparrowhawk is moving through, or a lion, and moving through the environment, and the food is not evenly spread through the environment. It's clumped. It's found in groups of animals, and when they find them, then they have to find them before they can hunt them. And so finding food is another major benefit that animals can get when they live in a group. And there's a number of processes by which they can do this. You'll learn a little bit in following lectures about social learning and so on. One of the processes is called local enhancement, which is simply to copy where others find food. And again, this is part of the same study by John Krebs. And what he did is he put model herons out in certain pools and counted the number of times that a flyover heron came down and landed in that pool. And he had a control, this is just basically no model herons, and he had 18 that flew over the area, and 8 of those landed in the pool, which is 30%. Then he put one model, and then when he had the one model out, he had 6 that flew over, six flew over, and another 11 flew and landed, which is 65%. And when he had five models, almost all of them landed. Okay, so this suggests that these individual herons cued in on the information when they saw one of the model herons, they came down and thought, oh, there must be food here. Okay. And remember, in the evolution lecture, we talked about Tim Bergen's four questions and the use of experiments. This is one of the real classic experiments where he used model herons to simulate the fact that maybe there's information available here. Okay, another process is, of course, when you live in a very large group, is that information can spread very rapidly among individuals about where food is. And one of these hypotheses is the the information center hypothesis, which is that when one of the big questions is, why do things like birds form these huge communal roosts? Okay, so you have a tree here. For some of you might have seen this in the winter. You get these massive flocks of starlings that come and they all roost together in this tree. You get the same with corvids. One of the hypotheses is that individuals that have found food, one day when they come in, other individuals can get information about which individuals found food and follow those individuals out the next day. So there's a really cool study was done on this. This was done on flocks of ravens in Wales. And what they did is they put carcasses of deer out. So ravens eat carrion, they eat dead animals. So they put carcasses of deer out, and in those carcasses they put little tiny plastic pellets. Okay, and they shoved it all through the meat. And so when the first ravens that discovered these pellets, these carcasses, ate the meat, they also ingested some of those little plastic pellets, and then they could go back to the roost and find where in the roost those individuals were located by looking at the droppings underneath the roost that had little plastic pellets in them. And what they found is that they found that as the days progressed, the location of those plastic pellets slowly grew away from the center of where the first individual was. So when the individual that first discovered the carcass in the morning on one day went back to the roost, it was maybe somewhere near the middle of the roost, and then the next day its neighbors in the roost also had plastic pellets in their droppings, and then the next day after that its neighbors, and so the information was spreading out in a concentric circle away from the first individual to discover the food. So this suggests that while they were spending the night in the roost, those neighbors were gaining information about the fact that that individual had found a carcass, and in the next morning followed that individual out to the carcass. Okay, larger groups are also likely to be much better at figuring out new food sources. So figuring out where there might be food. This is a great tit. One of nature's great problem solvers. Again, you'll hear more about this great tit problem solving when Lucy gives you a lecture in a couple of weeks. But one of the key hypotheses here is that larger groups are more likely to have individuals that are skilled problem solvers in them. So this is called the skill pool hypothesis. And this is a study done in Wharton Woods. This was during the same time as I did my PhD there. And they had this problem box. This is a really bad drawing of it. It's just a post with a clear perspex box, and I had a whole bunch of peanuts in this box, but to get the peanuts, the birds had to pull out two different levers. Okay, so they had to pull out the first lever, and then had to pull out the second lever. And no birds in the population were trained how to do this. They just had to figure it out. And what they found is that relative to the group size of birds that visited these problem-solving box, there was a relationship between group size and the probability of them solving the box. Okay, so larger groups had a greater probability of pulling out these two levers and gaining access to this food. These are the large groups here, then smaller groups. Okay. So being in a large group benefited some of these tits because they were able to get peanuts which were not accessible to small groups because the small groups never figured out how to do it. And of course, the information about how to do it can spread among individuals, and this is what we call social learning, and then you'll have a lecture about this in a couple of weeks. In fact, two lectures about this. Okay, to me, one of the more exciting areas of being in a group comes when you look at groups of predators. This video might not be very clear, but this is footage of a group of wild dogs. You can see the wild dogs here chasing wildebeest. And I think it's really fascinating that groups of hunters can come together and work together to catch prey. In this case, it's a simple relay system in which a couple of the dogs are really hot on the heels of the wildebeest chasing after them, while others are sort of running more slowly behind and just sort of resting. And when these become tired, these guys sort of come up to the front, and ultimately the group of wildebeest becomes tired before the group of wild dogs do, which allows the wild dogs to catch one of the wildebeest. So that's hunting in groups. I didn't add any more slides. I should add some more slides on that because I'm doing some more work on that at the moment. But that's a really cool area. But now we're going to flip to some other kinds of benefits. So getting food and avoiding predators is all about surviving, right, from one moment to the next. But actually, there's no point in surviving for animals if they can't reproduce, right? The ultimate aim of every animal is to reproduce. And so being in groups can benefit you by increasing your reproductive success. So Alex Jordan, I think, has a couple of lectures on this. And last week, Adriana talked to you about mating systems. One of the sort of really classic types of reproductive groups are what we call leks. So being in a larger group can benefit you because if you're a bunch of males, you're trying to attract females. So in many species, of course, they don't form stable pairs, but they're sort of polygynous. And the males are trying to attract females. And in some classic work on these weaver birds, so weaver birds are spread throughout Africa and Asia, and they build these amazing nests that they weave together. And one of the hypotheses for these weaver birds weaving these nests is that it represents a signal for females on where the males are. Okay, and they build over this entire tree. Sometimes these nests, trees can have hundreds of nests. And Nigel Collier's did some classic works on weaver birds, and he showed that there's a very strong positive relationship between the number of males in a colony and the number of females that are recruited into that colony. Okay, so females are more attracted to larger colonies, and this relationship, he should have put the one-to-one line, is not quite one-to-one, it's biased towards larger colonies of males. So a colony of maybe 60 males can attract over 100 females. Okay, so why do all animals just not live in giant big groups? Well, this is because large groups incur very large costs as well. Okay, being in a large group can also be very risky. It can be risky because you have to compete against other individuals to get the food, but you also might be more likely to get a disease. Okay, we all know this when we go to an airport, we're much more likely to come home sick than when we just live our normal lives. There's many, many individuals coming together. Okay, so more individuals means that there's more competition for limited resources. Okay, these resources can be food. So, for example, lions, they might catch a wildebeest, but that wildebeest can only go so far. It can't feed hundreds of lions. They can only feed a couple of lions, and so there's competition for that food. There's competition for nesting sites. Okay, in many species, such as birds that live in tree hollows and things, there's only a limited number of nesting sites. And also, of course, there's competition for mates. There's competition classically among males for females. Okay, so competition for food is fairly essential for survival, to be able to outcompete others. And one of the really neat studies on this sort of takes a slightly different approach. It takes the approach of saying, well, what are the kind of things that determine whether an individual makes a decision to attract other individuals into the food patch that it's in? And so these sparrows, these are tree sparrows again, they, when they find food, they make these little sort of chirrup noises that that basically tell other individuals in the group that there's food to be had here. And in a study by Mark Elgar, he shows that the type of food that is present determines the number of chirrups or the rate at which those sparrows make chirrups. And so if we focus mainly on this plot here, he had different kinds of food. He had no food. He had an eighth of a slice that was in one piece, or half a slice of bread that was in another piece. And then he had an eighth of a slice, but that was broken into crumbs, and birdseed, which is lots of little small pieces of food. And what he found is that the more divisible the food is, the more chirrups the sparrows made. Okay, so if there's a small bit of bread that is all in one piece, then if an individual finds that by itself and is joined by another individual, they're going to have to fight over that piece, right? Because there's only one piece available. And so that's going to create conflict, and so individuals are less likely to want to attract other individuals into that spot. However, if you have the same amount of bread, but that is all broken up into small crumbs, then another individual can come and both can feed simultaneously without really bothering each other. And so he finds that you get a massive increase in the number of chirrups when he broke the same amount of food into small pieces. Okay, so individuals are more, so these sparrows more likely to want to attract other sparrows when the food was more divisible or more easily shared among everyone. Now, when we look at the habitat in terms of the resources across the habitat, most species do something that we call the ideal food distribution, which is that they aggregate across food patches proportionally to the amount of resources available. So Adriana might have talked about this last week, about males spreading out across the territories of all the females, which is one of the classic mating systems. This is the same for animals that spread out across all of the available food. And you can do this experiment yourself. If you go with yourself and a friend, you go down to the park where there's some pigeons, you can basically feed sort of a small distance away. You can feed pigeons at different rates. You can feed some pigeons maybe twice as fast as other pigeons, or give twice as much food on one side as the other side. And what you'll observe is that you'll get the same proportion of pigeons relative to the amount of food that you give. So if you can have twice as much food here as here, then you get 2/3 of the pigeons here and 1/3 of the pigeons here. Now you can do the same with the gulls if you're down at the beach. Okay, so this looks a little bit like this. So in these experiments, Milinski, who's a director of Max Planck elsewhere in Germany, he did this by putting food in by these taps at different rates for sticklebacks, and he found that the sticklebacks spread themselves proportionally to the amount of food that was coming out of each tap. So in this case, there are 5 units of food coming out of this tap to every 1 unit of food at this tap, and so 5 of the sticklebacks went on this side and 1 of the sticklebacks went on that side. And this is just a formalization of the thing. You don't really need to learn that. Okay, there's also competition for nesting sites. So for example, in most of the woodland birds that we have here in Germany, these tits, for example, they nest in tree hollows, and there's only so many tree hollows available, and so they have to compete very strongly for the tree hollows. And a nice way of testing this hypothesis is to look at competition between species. Okay, so this was done in the UK, but we could do the same thing here. You have grey tits. Grey tits are about 18 grams each. And blue tits are about 10 grams each. So these are about half the size of these guys. And so the grey tits outcompete the blue tits for resources. And in this study that was done in Waitomo Woods, they looked at the density of nest boxes in an area and the percentage of blue tits that were present. So when there were few boxes, then there were fewer blue tits present because they were being outcompeted by grey tits. But as there were many, many more boxes, there were more boxes available than there were territories available for grey tits, then you had a higher proportion of blue tits. So there was more space available for blue tits. And so this suggests that the amount of resource was driving competition or driving the availability of the resource for blue tits relative to grey tits. And of course, competition for mate is the source of what we call sexual selection and has driven huge, amazing patterns in nature. So for example, these elephant seals that are just ginormous and they fight each other for access to females. So that's sort of access to resource and competition for resources. But of course, another major cost is if you form large groups, then any individual that gets a disease is more likely to transmit that disease to other individuals. And this was these are red-winged blackbirds or tri-colored blackbirds, this one. And in North America, these guys roost in these big common roosts. And there's a few examples in the last couple of years where people have basically woken up one morning and found that the ground was littered with dead birds because some disease has come in and just gone straight through the population extremely fast. Okay, this is studied a little bit more formally, mostly in a system, again in North America, of cliff swallows. These are similar to our tree swallows here. And they looked at the effect of colony density, so how tightly packed in the nests were in a colony, and the number of bugs or the number of parasites that they had per nest, and they found this strong positive relationship. So within a nest, a nest had more parasites in it if it was in a more dense colony. Okay, these ones up here. So some of these had some 600 of these little bugs in a single nest relative to very sparse colonies. So the nests were more spread out, and they might have fewer than 200 per nest. And that's a pretty massive difference. That's three times the amount of parasite load in a high-density colony than in a low-density colony. And this translates, of course, to the quality or to the well-being of the offspring, because, of course, these bugs, often what they do is they're sucking blood from the offspring, so the offspring requires more energy or has to produce more energy each day. And so if we look at the body mass per nestling as a function of the number of bugs per nestling, we can see this strong negative relationship. So in nests when they had many, many bugs, the chicks were typically much lighter. And again, we're talking about sort of 17 to 23, so we're talking about 25% difference in the body mass of chicks. And one of the things that is one of the best predictor of chick survival in almost all bird species is the weight of the nestlings. So the weight at which the chicks are when they leave the nest and they fledge. So for example, in great tits, because I know this because I've studied great tits for a long time, great tits are less than 15 grams when they fledge. They should be 20 grams, but great tits are less than 15 grams have basically 0% chance of being recruited into the population in the next year. So they're going to almost, 100% of them will die at some point in the summer. There's a very strong cost to having light nestlings. So the summary for the first part of this lecture is, of course, that group living is all about the balance between costs and benefits. And so costs come up from competition and disease. Benefits come from predation, avoiding predation, getting more foraging. And ultimately, this leads to what we call optimal group sizes and this sort of dynamic where we tend to not observe optimal group sizes, but typically group sizes that are larger than that. Okay, but a big question is, can we observe the evolution of group living? Can we observe this actually in action? And for this, I'm going to talk a little bit about the system in Trinidad of Trinidad guppies. Okay, so Trinidad is a pretty unique environment. It's like one of they call wild laboratories of evolution. Because what happened in Trinidad is you get, Trinidad is an island that's basically volcanoes that have come up. And on those volcanoes, you get lots of rivers. And the rivers look like this. You get pools of water interspersed by waterfalls. And what's happened over time is that guppies have been able to make their way up the river to sort of colonize pools of water. And in some cases, predators have also gone up. And in other cases, predators have not reached some of the pools. And so you get different populations of guppies. Some populations are exposed to predators regularly, and other populations have not been exposed to predators, sometimes for many generations. Okay, so classically, you'll get the other great thing is you get replication within streams such that at the higher pools, at some point, there's a waterfall that the predators can't get up, and so you get no predator guppies. And then just the next pool down, you get guppies that are faced with predators. Okay, so predators are a type of cichlid and these killifish. These guys did some experiments where they moved guppies between different streams. Some streams they came most. I think they all came from streams where there were no predators, and they put some in other streams where there were no predators, and some in streams where there were predators. And then they looked at the amount of schooling, or the sort of the propensity for these guppies to form groups 30 years later. So they sort of put them out, spread these guppies across these different streams, and then they went back and studied those populations again 30 years later. And they showed that in the streams where there were predations, where predation was present, where predators were present, the fish, these are replications in all except for one, they found that the guppies that were put there had higher schooling rates than the guppies that were put in replicated streams that had no predators. Okay, so these all came from the same starting populations. They all did the same thing at the start. And 30 years later, which I think is about 15 generations, they exhibit different schooling behaviors. So this suggests that group living evolved in these predation environments. Across from that study and then from a whole bunch of follow-up studies on this, but they've also found a whole bunch of really interesting other effects. So guppies that are in low predation environment, so guppies that were moved, I think these are guppies that were in high predation. No, these were guppies that were in low predation. At the start, when they placed them in environments that had no predation, they evolved over generations, they evolved brighter and more conspicuous spots, whereas when they moved them to high predation, they evolved to be much more plain. Okay, so of course, a guppy is easier to see if it's blue, right, against beige sand, and so if a predator is present, they evolve to be more coloured, more like the background environment, so that they're more cryptic. And predation really fundamentally affects life history. So as I said, it affects group living, but this is only just one aspect of it. And so in this paper, there's like a summary of all of the different things that they found. They found that in larger, in predation, I think they evolved smaller body size. So basically, guppies invested less in their body size in order to basically grow faster and reproduce earlier. They invested less in reproductive effort, so they produced fewer eggs, for example, and they had different morphology, they had different fin morphology, and so on. So, and they were less, of course, less colorful in the predation environment. Why would we study group living? So this whole lecture was about group living. I think next week you will get a lecture from Blair, a postdoc, following up on this. But why would we study group living? So one of the things you might notice is that some of many of the classical studies that I've shown you today are quite old. Some of them date from the 60s and 70s. So why are we still looking at these? Well, one reason is because it's becoming more and more clear for us now that social structure can be much more complex than just aggregation. So I've given you examples of why animals might come together to form groups in the first place, but once they do that, then all sorts of different things can happen. You can get different mating systems emerge, you can different social structures emerge. And these social structures, the fine scale structure can influence the transmission of information and transmission of disease, and we're only just starting to understand this. You can get collective behavior, and I think to me one of the most interesting things relates back to the evolution lecture that I gave some weeks ago, is that the social environment can really change how selection operates and how organisms evolve. This should be past lecture. And I think it also gives a really amazing window into our own evolutionary history, of course. Forming groups and being social is such a massive, important part of what we are, who we are as humans. And one of the ways in which we're making advances is through studying the social networks of animals. So you can think about individuals in a population as sort of these nodes, and they're sort of connected to other individuals in the populations through their interactions. For example, two animals that mate together have a connection, or two individuals that fight with each other. And these can be structured in different ways, and the structure of these has different properties on things such as the spread of information and spread of disease. And this is actually very much what we're looking at with the zebra finches. So this hevi that we've advertised is to help us understand how the structure of the connections among males and females in a population or in a colony of zebra finches affects the mating decisions that individuals have. Hey, this is an example of a social network. This is from Whiteham Woods in Oxford in this population of great tits. And here the tits, each individual is a node, and they're colored by different personalities that they have. So they looked at how exploratory each individual was and found that individuals that were sort of shyer or less exploratory were more likely to be found with other sort of shy individuals. And the really bold ones tended to be always in the sort of middle of the groups and connected with other bold ones. And I think this sort of captures a little bit about the kinds of personalities we have also as humans. And we've also, in the same system, found that individuals that are better connected also acquired more information. So they acquired information more quickly. Okay, so think about also with you, if you have more friends, you're more likely to get information about a party that is going to be happening on the weekend than someone that has fewer friends. Okay, and this same sort of thing happens in the wild as well, but we know very little about the sort of evolutionary consequences of this. And the same thing happens with transmission of disease. This is work done on giraffes, where they found that the social network, the social contacts among individuals is the best predictor of the spread of disease relative to other types of connections that individuals can have. And finally, in a bunch of studies by Joan Silk, who's at the University of Arizona, she's studied baboons for her whole career, and she's found some really, really amazing findings that baboon females that have stronger bonds with other baboon females have greater survival, and they also have a greater chance of infant survival. So their offspring are more likely to survive if they have more close associates relative to female baboons that had fewer associates. I think this is really amazing because it really says that the social environment in which you're in, your social connections are having an impact on your reproductive success and therefore your fitness. This is the plot that shows females with strong bonds, and this is their lifespan relative to females with weak bonds. And you can see that their survival rate stays up higher much longer. So they have almost 50% of them survive to be greater than 15 years old, whereas in the weak bond ones, 50% of them die by the time they're only 10 years old. So a massive difference. A third of your life longer as a female baboon if you have strong connections to other female baboons. Now, of course, when individuals come together, they can generate emergent outcomes that are not the properties of the individuals themselves, and this is what we call collective behavior. And again, this is the kind of thing we're trying to look at with the zebra finches. We're trying to understand how the mating system is a function of the behavior of all of the individuals combined rather than the behavior of any one individual by itself. And with that, I want to thank you for coming today, despite the horrible weather. And please come and ask me any questions, or if you have any questions about the hevi as well, happy to answer anything.